I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, we'll meet a realtor who specializes in alternative commuting. In previous decades, realtors could use a home's easy access to freeways as a selling point, but today's home buyers have other ways of getting around. Kirsten Kaufman is Portland, Oregon's bike realtor, and she'll tell us why location is still a consideration when buying a home, but location near different things. And we'll talk strategies for citywide change with Roxanne Manning of the Tallahassee Community Redevelopment Agency. Roxanne is heading up a program that will revitalize an overlooked but very special section of Tallahassee, Florida, in hopes of priming the neighborhood for smart growth. All that, plus the latest news from Plan Edison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up on today's Smart City. But first, this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. If you're shopping for a new home, there are a number of things to consider. How many bedrooms? How many bathrooms? But a good thing to keep in mind is how close you are to transit and your daily destinations. Whether you're on a bus line or near the light rail, my next guest, Kirsten Kaufman, has specialized in selling homes to people who don't use a car to get around. She's known as Portland's bike realtor. Kirsten, you call yourself the bike realtor, specializing in homes for cyclists and alt commuters. I love that. Can you describe that market demographically?
Sure. I really specialize in helping people who want to drive less. So they may be walking, they may be biking, they may be using public transportation. And that demographic can include just about anyone. A lot of the business that I've done over the last 6 months has been with younger first-time homebuyers, many of whom are just getting ready to start families but haven't yet. You know, so they're young and pretty agile for the most part, the folks that I've been working with. But I do have other clients who, you know, have different demographic features, I guess you would say.
So what do people who want to drive less look for in a home?
I like to take the old adage of real estate, which is location, 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 and reframe that in terms of proximity, proximity, proximity. They are looking to be close to shopping. They're looking to be close to their children's schools if they have children or are planning children. They're looking to be close to access to their workplaces. So whether they're looking to be on a bus line or a light rail line, or they're looking to be on a bike thoroughfare. So we're really blessed here in Portland with some great networks of bicycle throughways called bike boulevards. And those are really fantastic for getting people around the city safely on their bicycles.
Explain a bike boulevard for those who don't know.
Sure. Bike boulevards are neighborhood streets which run kind of parallel to busier car thoroughfares. And so they provide direct access through the city, but on quiet, traffic-calm streets. So they have special features that make them less desirable for motorists. So the stop signs are hinder motorists and allow bicyclists access. And also there are like roundabouts and things like that that make it more of a pain for a person in a car, but make it really nice and quiet for someone on a bike.
Are there really enough home buyers who are cyclists, who are alt commuters, who do want to drive less to keep you busy?
Well, I have to tell you, this has been, since I specialized in this niche, it's been the best thing I've done for my business. It has increased my business significantly. And there are, as a matter of fact, other realtors in Portland who do a lot of business on their bikes and also cater to this group. And I think there's plenty of business for all of us. It's been great. And most of the people I'm working with are either car-free or have one car that they don't use a whole lot, maybe just on the weekends.
So you're seeing car-free home buyers?
Yep. I think there's a misconception that people who don't have cars maybe don't have money. And that's definitely not what I'm seeing. Most of my clients are putting down 20% on their home purchases.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. So they've got the money to spend. They're just not spending. I guess it's because they're not spending it on a car.
Maybe so.
Maybe so. Now, I can remember the days, Kirsten, when you didn't want to live near a bus stop, right? Because all of those people would be standing at the bus stop and they would drop their trash on my lawn or my sidewalk. And so it's like, ugh, get me away from this bus stop. That's not the case in Portland?
Well, I would say people still don't necessarily want to be right on the bus stop. They might want to be a block off the bus stop. Some people don't mind it, and they're definitely different characteristics of different bus lines here in Portland. But yeah, I think a block from the bus stop's real attractive.
Have you seen the new research that says homes that are in much more walkable neighborhoods that have that proximity you talked about are worth more, in some cases, much more than identical houses in neighborhoods that are less walkable?
You know, I've been trying to track this research down myself because I completely believe it. And I've been looking for ways to document this here in Portland. I haven't.
Well, you just have to go to the Smart City website at CE. We will have it there. So smartcityradio.com, you'll find it there. But it is the case. And I'm wondering if your experience as a realtor in Portland suggests to you that people, in fact, are willing to pay more for houses with more proximity.
Oh, absolutely. And I would also say that my clients aren't willing to even consider homes that don't have proximity. It's, you know, a key, you know, must have on their criteria list. So we're definitely seeing the growing demand for homes that are in walkable and bikeable locations. Walk Score is a popular tool for a lot of my clients, which, you know, shows you the walkability of a property. And we're trying to get it added to our local multiple listing service as a criteria that we can all search.
Wow. So your home buyers are actually checking out their property's Walk Score. Do they come to you knowing that?
Most of my clients are pretty internet savvy, and many of them do know about Walk Score, but I definitely promote it to everyone and use it myself.
Do you? So you search the Walk Scores on each of the properties that you're showing and representing and using that as a selling tool for the homes?
Most definitely, and on my listings as well. I specialize in or mostly work with buyers at the moment, but I do have some listings, and I always use that as a selling tool.
Let me ask you something. You know, we went through a period where everybody seemed to want a McMansion, right? It was all about how many closets, how many bedrooms, how many bathrooms you could actually load onto a house. And it feels to me, but only anecdotally as someone who's not in the business, that people are beginning to turn away from that a little bit. Do you see a trend toward people valuing a smaller home?
That's an interesting question. I think that the market area that I'm working in, which is real urban, I work with people who want to live really close in. I mean, Portland's not a big city, but the people that I work with want to live in the city. And so the McMansion thing hasn't, I don't think it ever really caught on real big in the market segment that I'm working in. So the people that I work with are happy to make the trade-offs. They could buy a $300,000 house that's around the corner from a food co-op, you know, that has all organic weekly farmers market. They would take a two-bedroom, one-bath house that's $300,000 versus a five-bedroom house in the suburbs.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm, any day of the week.
And I mean, how do you hear them talk about it? How have you learned to talk about that? A smaller home with better proximity as an asset. I mean, how do you sell it?
You know, it's funny. I just believe in it myself so much. And from my personal experience in choosing the homes that I've chosen and recently having moved to a home that worked better for my family and our lifestyle, which doesn't revolve around driving, I think I attract like-minded people. I also find that I had a really kind of interesting. I started talking to my clients. I noticed that a whole bunch of them don't have televisions. But I suspect a lot of them listen to public radio. So I think there's definitely a progressive mindset here in Portland that we're known for. And this is a big part of it.
Talk a little bit more about something you said that I find really interesting, Kirsten. They have lifestyles that don't revolve around striving. Talk about that a little bit more. What do you mean when you say that about yourself?
Oh, about myself. Well, let's see. I have three children, I should say. So people are often surprised that we do have a van, and we use it probably once or twice a week at the most. We try to do everything as much as possible by bike, and we have lots of contraptions to carry groceries and carry kids and do a lot of kind of fun outdoor activities. Of course, it's summer here in Portland, our blessed few months of sunshine. But we also, during the winter, it's kind of a point of pride to say that, you know, our kids, I think last year, got driven to school once.
Wow. And for you, is that a moral choice you're making, you feel like you're making? Is it just... it's just a more delightful lifestyle. I mean, what is it that keeps you from driving your kids to school? Are you making them? How do you talk to yourself about that? Are you making them better people? I mean, what's going on there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, there are so many reasons I could list, and I'm sure you talk about them on your show a lot, about, you know, the reasons for driving less. I mean, obviously there are environmental concerns, and that's a big concern of my family. But really what it comes down to is I think we're happier when we're out of the car and when we're getting some activity. I should say my three kids are all boys, so I have to run them like dogs.
Activity is very important.
So activity is huge. And, you know, it's hard to work in that getting to the gym every day or working exercise into your routine. And if you are just making it part of your lifestyle, then you don't have to think about that quite so much. Yeah, and I think it really helps us feel more integrated in our community, and I think that's a huge part of what I see with the people that I work with, is that there is that sense of community that you get when you're biking or walking in your neighborhood versus driving through it.
I love that. Let me ask you this, shifting subjects just a bit, Kirsten. Is there a particular type of retail restaurant, service business that makes it easier to sell a home if that particular type of business is nearby? Is there something that signals this is a neighborhood you want to live in for the lifestyle you've just described?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Farmers markets. And, you know, they're gaining popularity everywhere, but definitely people are looking for farmers markets. And those, for the most part, are seasonal, but we do have at least one year-round farmers market here in Portland. Organic foods or natural food markets are also attractive to buyers. And I think when they add those to a neighborhood, I've seen home values just go up because of that. And we have one chain, local chain in particular, that's kind of known for bringing up the neighborhood, so to speak.
What is that local chain?
That's New Seasons Market.
That's locally owned, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when a New Seasons is coming into the neighborhood, the real estate agents start advertising it, you know, a year before it gets there. So those types of businesses are great. Parks are always a plus. Restaurants, things like that, that people can walk through, like a conglomeration, a business district. Portland is really known for its neighborhoods and its sort of neighborhood districts. So we have, you know, different areas that are known for their vibrancy. So you can go to a place that's not necessarily downtown and find shops and restaurants and attractions and entertainment.
That really is one of the things that makes Portland so special. The unemployment rate in Portland remains very high. In fact, it's higher than average across the country. Yet young people continue to flock to Portland. So what's the magic there?
You know, I really do attribute it to the lifestyle that we have here and this ability to live essentially car-free. I think it's huge for young people. I think the neighborhood feel, the vibrancy of our neighborhoods has a lot to do with that. And then once you get a conglomeration of, you know, young folks in a certain place, it tends to feed on itself. I do have a certain number of people that I've talked to who are watching our market very carefully, who are retirees, who are looking to move here to also lead that kind of lifestyle, which I see as kind of a more European lifestyle here in Portland once they can sell their property elsewhere.
That does hinder movement, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But one thing for young home buyers that I've been seeing is there's been an $8,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been fueling a lot of my business.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What's on the subject of the economy for a minute, one of the things that we've agreed makes Portland so great are these small neighborhood business districts that are so fabulous. And they're populated with independent retail, independently owned restaurants and coffee shops. What's happening with those small retail shops and restaurants in Portland? Are they hanging on right now?
They're doing their best. I mean, we've definitely had some businesses are struggling, but there's still an amazing number of small businesses. And, you know, I think I recently read that the number of people starting new businesses has increased substantially with the economic downturn. So people are getting maybe laid off of jobs and finding resources to start their own entrepreneurial pursuits. And one thing that I'm really excited about on the business front is the formation of a bicycle business league here in Portland. I'm a member of. And so we have a group of business people who primarily conduct their businesses by bicycle. So I'm excited about that group and try to incorporate their services as much as possible into what I do.
Mm-hmm. That is so cool. Now, so people like you as a realtor who are conducting their business by bikes?
Yep. Let's see. So we have cargo bikes are huge here in Portland. So people are building all kinds of bikes to carry ridiculous loads around.
It's like Shanghai.
Yeah, exactly. And they're really catching on. And so, you know, we have bike builders. But we also have people who are taking advantage of this cargo bike craze. So we have people that are making pretty large deliveries by bicycle. We have home cleaning services by bike. There's a bicycle gardener and landscaper and other people who are doing bicycle tours and rentals in Portland. I'm sure I'm forgetting actually one of my favorite people who deliver soup by bicycle. You can get subscriptions to organic homemade soup that he brings to you on his bike. That's one of my favorite closing gifts for my clients.
You may sell some homes just on this radio show. You're making Portland sound so great, which it is. What do you predict for Portland over the next 12 to 24 months? Can you tell from your business the number of people looking and intending to buy? Can you get a sense of where the economy's headed?
You know, that's a question that we're all grappling with and have been, you know, kind of taking swipes at for many months now. We have seen our housing inventory come down significantly this summer, which is a relief to everyone. And so we're in better shape than we were in terms of inventory, number of unsold homes this year versus this time last year. However, you know, we're seeing more short sales and foreclosures, and we are still seeing declining prices and home values. So those are the downsides and the things that I think are going to keep the market somewhat depressed here for the next probably year or so. Again, the job market as well is dragging us down. if we see that first-time home buyer credit extended this year into next, I think that's going to be real helpful. But nobody knows for sure whether that will happen because the government needs money for lots of things right now. So,
but that's helpful to you.
It's been a huge help for me. Yeah, for my clients.
Let me ask you one, I guess, off the wall question, but I'm curious what role you see art and culture playing in Portland and in the, you know, what you've described really as the wonderful livability of the city. Is that a contributor? Is that something that people think about in Portland? Just curious where that fits into the mix.
Oh, absolutely. Art and culture are huge in Portland, and people might not think of it that way because we are kind of, you know, on the scale of, you know, metropolitan areas, somewhat small. But we have a very vibrant, independent art scene here, and we have, as a matter of fact, we have a First Friday art walk. That's kind of the mainstream one, and then there's a Last Thursday art walk on the other side of the river in the Alberta neighborhood, which is a very popular neighborhood for a lot of my clients. And it was just recently made completely car-free, so they closed down the streets for it, and it's like a big street fair. You can walk and ride your bike freely without any cars to bother you. And there's street performers and art exhibits and musicians everywhere.
Well, it sounds like fun. Kirsten Kaufman, I love the business that you've established for yourself, the specialty in real estate for people who want to drive less. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for having me.
Kirsten Kaufman is the Bike Realtor of Portland, Oregon. We have links to more information about her on our website, smartcityradio.com. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
They call it the Motor City, but with a hard decline in the American auto industry, the name just doesn't seem to fit right anymore. Locals are trying to find ways for the struggling city to reinvent itself and diversify its lackluster economy. One suggestion city planners have dreamed up is fashion, according to a recent article from CNN Money. And while it might seem like a stretch, the crossover from automaking to fashion design is not as far as you might think. Many say that tapping into the creative minds behind car design will make Detroit a new fashion center, and the transition is already underway. Since 2005, the city has hosted its own Fashion Week, just like traditional fashion cities like New York and London. And in an effort to raise the city's fashion profile, a second runway event is scheduled for this fall. By highlighting local designers, organizers hope to draw more attention to the local creative economy and attract more young people to a city that has for decades seen its young adult population skip town for hipper digs. While it may be true that the city's industrial days are dwindling, Detroit may emerge with a new, more stylish identity. Meanwhile, out in sprawling Phoenix, where driving is a major part of the city's DNA, another surprising shift is happening. The city's new light rail system is boasting high ridership numbers, much higher than anybody, even supporters, had imagined possible. A recent article from the New York Times looks at the new Valley Metro Light Rail line, which opened back in December with expectations of about 26,000 riders per day. But now, ridership stats show that nearly 33,000 people are riding the train per day, a figure that has caused many to recant on earlier predictions that the project would be a monumental waste of money. But unlike many of the other transit systems in the U.S., the high ridership numbers in Phoenix aren't being caused by commuters. The bulk of ridership is apparently coming from pleasure trips on the weekends. Only 27% of riders are using the train to commute, according to transit officials. Whatever their reason, people are riding the rails in Phoenix, which has come as a happy surprise to many transit advocates. And it's helping to bolster their case for planned expansion of the system over the next decade. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll find out how one neighborhood redevelopment is inspiring some non-governmental bodies to create some real change in the city of Tallahassee, Florida. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The Gaines Street Corridor in Tallahassee, Florida, is an overlooked but special part of the city. Located in the heart of the city and immediately adjacent to the historic downtown, the Gaines Street Corridor is a prime location that's about to see a renaissance. My guest, Roxanne Manning, is the head of the Tallahassee Community Redevelopment Agency and new project manager for the Gaines Street Corridor revitalization effort. Roxanne, tell me about the Gaines Street Corridor and its significance to the city.
Well, several years ago, back in the mid-90s, the city realized that one thing that they were lacking, I think, is a heart or a place for people to gather. We have some areas like that in the downtown that were originally intended to be areas where people could interact with each other and get together. But unfortunately, those uses were not supported or surrounded by other uses which contributed to the dynamic there. So staff was looking around with the commission and trying to find an area that they could develop into an entertainment district for the city. And they looked at the Gaines Street area. Now, Gaines Street's unique because it's actually an old railroad staging area. It's one of the oldest streets in town. And basically, what is there now? There's a lot of vacant property. There's some old warehouses left. And there are a few uses that have come in and just sort of hung on by the skin of their teeth, if you will. Gaines Street itself is a four-lane corridor. It's a commuter corridor with very high traffic area. And during the late 1990s, the city put a group together called the Gaines Street Vitalization Committee, and that group put together a plan for the redevelopment of the Gaines Street District.
Let's go back and talk for a minute about Tallahassee. For our listeners who are not familiar with the city, describe it.
Tallahassee is a small to moderate-sized city. We are the state capital of Florida. We have two wonderful universities located very close to the downtown. We have Florida State University and FAMU, Florida Agricultural and Mechanical University. In our downtown area, it's a little bit unique because we have city government, county government, and state government. So we're very heavily occupied by offices and government buildings in the downtown.
Now, you said that originally downtown was meant to be the heart of the city. Every city needs a heart. But that the uses that you felt were essential to the heart of a city could not be supported in downtown. Explain what you meant by that.
Well, one of the dynamics that we've identified in a city like Tallahassee, where you're a capital city and a university town, the downtown, a lot of the property is taken up with government uses. And when you have the state capitol there, you know, you have a lot of attorneys' offices, you have lobbyists' offices, and that tends to take up a lot of the prime real estate in your downtown. Retail uses, entertainment uses, and restaurants find it very hard to compete with the type of rents that are required for the office uses. And so what happens is essentially you have the 8-to-5 downtown that sort of closes up at night. And that's an issue that we've had to deal with in Tallahassee.
And there were no opportunities to add housing in upper floors or in Class B or C office space?
Actually, we have done that. We've got several new developments that are just now coming online. And the upper floors, I think we have one building that's about 15 stories at least, the upper floors are residential. But the lower floors, they're finding very difficult to rent out for the retail or entertainment uses that we originally intended to go there.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, you've got office, you're adding residential, but it's still not enough to make it lively. So what is the relationship between downtown and the Gaines Street Corridor? Are they linked? Are they connected? Are they close together geographically?
They are very close together. In fact, the Gaines Street Corridor itself serves as a main entryway into our downtown. It's also immediately adjacent to both universities. So you have this sort of nexus on Gaines Street between two universities and the downtown area that makes it perfect for this kind of redevelopment.
So the city organized in the late 90s to redevelop the Gaines Street Corridor. Okay, it's now, what, a decade later? So what's been the path, and where are you today?
It was an interesting but not unusual path for a lot of big urban projects. What happened was they put together a committee went through all the charrettes and developed a plan. The plan was adopted in 2000 by the City Commission. And since that time, it's just languished a little bit for several reasons. You know, a little bit of the work was done. For example, the city adopted the development or the zoning codes for the Gayne Street District, and they acquired some property for redevelopment. But as far as physical construction or implementation of the physical plan itself, that is what was languishing.
So the physical plan itself was languishing. Why?
I think that happens for several reasons. Tallahassee is really not unique in that respect. You know, a lot of cities adopt these wonderful plans, and they sit on the shelf and they're never built. And there are several reasons. For example, there's, I think, a fear of commitment. Local governments look at these plans and they realize, you know, they're very expensive. They can be very challenging and complex to build. There's a little bit of a fear of the unknown because you have this district that's built in one way and you're going to completely redo it into something that may be very, very different, in Tallahassee's case, very different than what is there now. And I think there's almost a reluctance in some cases to pull the trigger on a project like that. There may also be financial issues. There may be physical problems that were unanticipated. For example, in Tallahassee's case, they found significant contamination on a lot of the sites that they wanted to build on. And when you combine all of these things, that can result in a project that does sit on the shelf and doesn't get built the way it was originally intended to be.
So then what broke the logjam?
Several things did, but one of the key movers, I think, in breaking the logjam was support from the Knights Creative Communities Initiative, KCCI. They created a group of people called Catalysts and started a group called Get Gaines Going, and that group basically became the lobbying group for the Gaines Street project. They contacted city leaders and said, you know, we really want this. We believe in this project. We think it can happen. What do we need to do to get it started? And the city responded beautifully. They basically started to put a real emphasis on getting this project built. They appointed me to head it up and basically said, do what you need to do to get this thing off the ground. And that's what we're doing.
Let's go back and talk about the Knight Creative Communities. That's the Knight Foundation. And they funded Catalyst, right? Creative Catalyst, who then focused on this project. Is that about the way it worked?
Right. I think they were all volunteers, though, but they did fund or they did form a group of catalysts, and they had several different projects. One was, for example, a film festival, and then, you know, another one was the Get Gaines Going group.
It's interesting. Do you know how much money the Knight Foundation has put into this effort? I'm trying to help sort of set a benchmark. You've got a small to mid-sized city with some clear assets, but you couldn't get this thing moving. Then you had this external force called the Knight Foundation, the Knight Creative Communities, that enabled some local organizing that has then now broken the logjam. So just to provide a benchmark for other cities, do you know the amount Knight invested in that?
As far as creating the local catalyst groups, I really do not have a figure. I do know that the people who participated in those groups are local leaders, people who are just involved in the community. And the big service that they provided was to bring attention to the project and give it the kind of moral support that enabled the city to just say, yeah, we can do this. Let's get it done.
Do they view themselves as a political group? I mean, tell me a little bit about Get Gaines Going. Tell me more about that. How they view themselves, how they're organized. Is this a more of a task force and less of an organization, or is this something that has permanence?
It's actually, I would call it a task force. There were about 11 people in the group, and they said, you know, this is something that we think needs to happen. And they got together, started meeting. They were, you know, identifying what the issues are and how to resolve the individual issues. And basically what they felt was that it just needed more support at the political level.
So the issues or the barriers were political in their minds. And I guess they were, because now you're making progress. Tell me what you've done to date.
Actually, we've done a lot. One of the first things that we did was we sat down with all of the city staff members who would be involved in this and identified what the issues are that we need to overcome to make this project happen. And there were several. I mean, the funding was in place, but we had issues, for example, with not owning the road right-of-way. We have a very limited right-of-way now that we've acquired it. It's a very limited right-of-way that we can build in. We had old infrastructure that was buried at a very shallow depth, so we weren't able to use some of the more innovative techniques like pipe bursting to actually do the construction. I believe I mentioned we had contamination. We had to figure out how to deal with the commuters. We have 35,000 trips per day on average that we have to deal with going on Gain Street right now. So I think all of those issues taken together basically kept the project from moving forward. And also they needed to have a project leader or head honcho or trail boss, whatever you want to call it. They need to have someone in place whose responsibility is and who's empowered by the city to make it happen, to do what you need to do. And those are the steps that the city took when they decided to get this going.
So you call yourself trail boss?
No.
There's all kinds. I love that. I'm sort of digging that, Roxanne. That's kind of cool.
I think that's probably one of the most appropriate descriptions, because this person is not a project manager. They don't really make technical decisions, but their job is to round everybody up, keep them all moving in the same direction, you know, overcome obstacles, and that's essentially what I do. So I thought trail boss was a pretty good description.
I like it. Let's come back to mobilizing city staff. I mean, often what we run into, you've seen this, of course, is the traffic engineer is focused on moving traffic, and then you have someone else that's focused on something that is also important, but the two are never talking to one another to resolve what it really takes to satisfy citizens and make something specific happen, to make a specific experience happen for citizens. Were you able to sort of keep people the specialists talking to one another?
A lot of times in local government, we do see, you know, staff working on their projects, and they have different priorities, and basically they have to answer to all of those priorities. But when Gain Street was elevated to the level of a priority project by the city manager, staff already was having some conversations about making it happen, but when we pulled everyone together, made it a priority, started with the regular meetings and the tracking of the project, there was a lot more conversation that took place. And when we had the list of challenges that we needed to work on, we knew what the challenges were, we put them in order, and we just started ticking them off one by one, that kept the conversation going. That kept it moving.
If plans aren't big and bold, then people think you don't have any vision. But if plans are big and bold, they take time to achieve and people lose patience. How do you balance those tensions?
One of the things I recommend is that when you are working on the plan, on the initial plan itself, you have to plan for the build. You know, not only do you put the design together, which is a lot of fun, and you've got the, you know, the wonderful renderings and all the creativity, but as part of that plan, you plan how you're going to build it, how you're going to build the project. And there are a lot of different approaches. And, you know, there's one approach, for example, let it occur organically. You know, do the regulations, do the drawings, and then as it redevelops over time, then you'll achieve your plan. That can take decades. So, you know, if that's going to be your path, then you need to let people know that up front. Let your citizens know, we have this plan. We think it'll take about 25 years to achieve. If you're going to try and implement it in pieces, then you need to let people know that. You need to quantify while you're doing the plan what the different steps are that you're going to take, who's going to take them, who's responsible, for example, for acquiring the property to redevelop, who's going to build the road. And when you do that, then again, you need to go back and you need to put someone in charge. You know, the trail boss concept, it's someone who represents the city. It can be a city staff member. And their job is to keep that project moving, keep it organized. But I think you have to start that from the beginning.
You've described the very positive role that citizens played in the Gaines Street corridor. Sometimes citizens have a very contentious relationship with their local government. What was the nature of this relationship that made it so productive?
I think one reason is the people who were involved saw themselves in a support role, the Get Gaines Going group. They were, you know, very vocal, very outspoken, but it was in a supportive manner. They weren't being critical. They weren't being adversarial. They just wanted to help. And when you have a group like that, it can create such a good energy. And I believe that's what happened in this case.
In the corridor, you've set up something you call a green roof incentive zone. Explain the green roof incentive zone.
Well, that's something that we're working on. One of the big issues that we identified early on for the property along both sides of Gaines Street or in the Gaines District is the stormwater planning. We know that we have some deficiencies that we're going to have to overcome in how we handle the volume of stormwater that we expect to be generated by the amount of development that we want. One thing that we are looking at is an incentive for the developers to put in green roofs, the goal being really twofold. One, we'd like to see some reduction in our volume of stormwater. And also, there's a long-term benefit with regard to energy costs. We know that they can reduce the amount of heating and cooling required for a building. So that's something that we're looking at. We have several issues that we need to overcome to do it, among them being how much credit can you give somebody for stormwater reduction? Because in turn, we'll have to size our stormwater conveyance systems based on that. So we're looking at that right now, and we hope to develop something and put it in place.
And the incentive would come in the form of what?
Probably a financial incentive to help them pay for the differential in cost in building the green roof. And there may also be a density incentive as well.
Well, let me ask you about that. That always strikes me as strange because really you want density, right?
Yes, we do.
Okay, so if you want it, why don't you just offer it up? Why does somebody have to sort of do something special to get what you actually want? I've always wondered about it. That's never made any sense to me.
Well, in a lot of cases, there's almost like, think of it as a carrying capacity. If you have infrastructure in place, whether it's stormwater infrastructure or water, you know, potable water and sewer infrastructure, there's a certain amount of density that you can support. Now, if you're going to increase that, if you're going to add additional density, at some point you're going to be resizing your infrastructure to handle that. One way to do that is to offer an incentive. If you'll do this, if you'll put in a green roof and reduce the amount of stormwater that you generate, we won't have to resize our facility down the road, so we'll let you have a little bit of extra density to handle that. So basically, it's a trade-off.
Got it. So basically what you're doing is you're providing more carrying capacity for the increased density, which costs the city money, but they're doing something the city wants. I mean, is that essentially the equation?
Yeah. They're doing something that we'd like to see happen, but by, for example, implementing a green roof, they are not going...
Yeah, they're reducing the essentially the carrying cost of stormwater treatment, as an example.
Right, they are. We won't have to resize our system later on. We can just go ahead and use what we have.
Let me ask you one final question, Roxanne. What effect do you want the corridor to have? Once it's built, what benefit will it be to citizens? What's the effect you want?
One of the things we're doing, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about human interaction being, you know, a real key element in a successful urban space. So we have designed this project to basically provide sidewalks and gathering spaces that are intermixed with the buildings that will allow people to go there and, as part of their daily routine, interact with other people, gather, see other people on the sidewalk, meet your friends, that kind of thing. I think that's incredibly important to a successful city. And if you can't provide that, you're going to lose some of the people that you desperately want to keep. For example, our college graduates. You know, there were surveys done by the Knight Foundation that identified a desire among the younger people to have places like that where they could gather. So in designing Gayne Street, that's one of the goals that we want to meet. We also want to keep it real, so to speak. We're not looking for, you know, the very structured, sterile kind of brand new shopping or structured entertainment district. We want a place where people will go during their daily life. You might go there to have coffee or buy a book or do your grocery shopping. It's a place it's a natural part, a natural extension of the city.
Roxanne, thank you so much for being our guest on Smart City today.
Thank you very much. I have really enjoyed it.
Roxanne Manning is the head of the Tallahassee Community Redevelopment Agency and new project manager of the Gayne Street Corridor revitalization effort. Finally, this week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith sheds a little light on certain claims about the U.S. healthcare system.
What concerns me the most about healthcare in America are the facts about it. There has been a presumption throughout the recent debate over healthcare that the U.S. healthcare system is the best in the world. In fact, President Obama made that very statement in his recently nationally televised speech to the joint session of Congress. Healthcare in America is very good, but according to the facts I've seen, there is still a lot of room for improvement relative to other countries around the world. In 2000, the World Health Organization ranked the U.S. healthcare system at 37th worldwide, just below Costa Rica and only two slots above Cuba. Of course, one big component of this ranking relates to access and undercoverage. The U.S. ranks so low because we have so many people without health insurance, a number that rose for the eighth year in a row in recently released census figures. Unemployment due to the recession added 1.1 million people to the number of those without health insurance, bringing the total now to 46.3 million. But let's leave this issue aside, as well as issues of cost, and focus just on performance. We know that coverage is too low and costs are way too high, but while fixing those problems is essential, I have a deeper concern. The World Health Organization also provides rankings by each of the individual components used to compute its overall average. In terms of level of care, the one to focus on is the so-called DALE measure, or disability-adjusted life expectancy. In other words, how many years of good health can we expect given the health care available to us in America? On this measure, the U.S. ranks a mere 24th worldwide. Better than overall, but still far from the best in the world. Indeed, in terms of average life expectancy unadjusted for disability, the U.S. ranks 34th in the world, with an average lifespan of slightly more than 78. This is a mere half year more than Cuba, and 4.5 years less than the number one country of Andorra, which is located on the border of Spain and France in southwestern Europe. Places in China far exceed the U.S. In Hong Kong, the average lifespan is nearly 82, and in Macau, it is over 84. Now, mind you, this is not to say that the U.S. healthcare system is bad. It is only to make the point that it is not always the best in the world. There is a lot of variation. The U.S. is by far the best place to get care if you have cancer. Across nearly every type of cancer, 5-year survival rates in this country are at the top or very near the top. But the percentage of U.S. children with DPT and measles vaccinations trails that in countries like the Czech Republic, Hungary, Iceland, Mexico, the Netherlands, Poland, Portugal, Spain, and Sweden. And infant mortality in the U.S. ranks poorly. It is 29th worldwide, dropping significantly from 12th worldwide in 1960. U.S. women rank 8th worldwide in terms of obesity. Men rank 5th, not rankings where you want to be high. In a 1998 ranking of the U.S. by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the U.S. was in the 31st percentile in terms of potential years of life lost. Again, not a ranking where being in the upper third of countries worldwide is a good thing. At least the U.S. had improved from 1980, when it was in the 19th percentile. But there is room for more improvement. Indeed, this is my concern. There are many things to fix in our healthcare system. But we will get these changes done properly only if we lose our hubris about everything American being the best in the world. Our healthcare system is good, make no mistake. But there is plenty of room for improvement, even in the quality of care. And facing up to that will help us get to where we ought to be with the health care that all Americans deserve. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. There's lots more Smart City on our website, smartcityradio.com. You can read my blog, sign up for the weekly newsletter, or subscribe to the podcast. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or by emailing us questions to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. I'm Carol Coletta.